RemotePC.com.
Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Well, in the background, we're listening to one of the songs from the album Will the Circle Be Unbroken by the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band and some of the greatest names in country music, Mabel Carter, Doc Watson, Earl Scruggs, and Merle Travis. Our guest is John McEwen, who is a founding member of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, and he's joining us live in the studio right now. And John McEwen, welcome to WMNF. So great to have you here.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you for coming on.
Well, so, it's nice to go to a station I can drive to.
So you moved to the Tampa Bay area.
Yeah, I did.
You're a California guy. You were born in...
I was born in Oakland, California. First thing I learned to say was, get me out of here. And I did. I moved to Southern California by high school and graduated from Garden Grove High School, 1963.
What kind of music did you listen to growing up?
None. Every now and then something would, the 50s radio, what my brother was listening to. But I didn't get into music until I was 17. And I felt a need to play the guitar because my older brother, that's Bill, he's 6 months older than me. And it's a country thing. No, he's 5 years older. But he was playing Jimmy Reed type of music and stuff. And he showed me a couple things. But at 17 and a half, I saw the Dillards in a club in Los Angeles area, and that took me away. I went home and took the fifth string off my guitar and put a first string on to make it like a banjo, and then had to go back to see them to figure out how to tune it.
Well, what a career it was. You have quite a history in music. We're going to talk about that today, from playing with country music royalty on the album Will the Circle Be Unbroken, to teaching Steve Martin how to play the banjo, to touring with the band, the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, through the Soviet Union, to being on Saturday Night Live, to playing and recording with such artists as Bob Dylan, the Allman Brothers, Phish, Steve Goodman, June Carter Cash, Dolly Parton, Arlo Guthrie, Johnny Cash, and Willie Nelson, just to name a few. Yeah. And that's just a partial list. And this fall, he appeared in Ken Burns' documentary on country music on PBS.
That was quite a show.
He's won a Grammy and an Emmy, and he'll be performing in the area this week several times. And John McEwen, it's a great honor to have you here.
Oh, well, thank you. It's an honor to be on this show.
So I was listening to some of your early music, and when you how did you join the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band?
Well, it was a group of guys hanging around a music store in Long Beach, California, a store called McCabe's Guitar Shop, and there was a coffee table that we'd all gather around and play. And a year or so went by, and I started a group called the Wilmore City Moonshiners with a guy that was 16 years old named Wes Thompson. That lasted about 9 months or a year. Then it broke up, and then I went and played with Michael Murphy before he became Michael Martin Murphy. And after 6 months of that, I got tired of that, and then Les called me and said, hey, the guys at the music store are getting together. You want to come play with us? I said, well, what are you calling it? Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. Well, that sounds interesting. They'd been playing about 2 months, doing a few coffee house type of things, and I hooked up with them. It was August 12th, 1966, noon. At 1 o'clock.
I read that you replaced Jackson Browne in the band.
Well, Jackson doesn't know that. Jackson was using the band to back him up on his songs. He wasn't really in the band. He never, when I talked to Jackson, he says, well, that's okay. And that's okay. A couple guys in the group like to say Jackson Brown was in the Dirt Band. Well, you know, there isn't a publicity picture. There's one poster with him mentioned. Actually, I think he opened for us, and never got a paycheck and all that stuff. But it's fine. We were a bunch of kids, a bunch of teenagers. I was 20 years old. Les was 17. Jeff was 18. Jimmy was 17 or 18, and the other two guys were. Anyway, that goes by so fast that summer, and by August, we were rehearsing. My brother got us a record deal. And which is very, very unusual because our first review said doubtful if they'll ever be captured on record. And that was around November or so. And then December, we were working with Merle Travis at the Ash Grove, which is now called the Improv. We did 10 days there. And then we started recording an album for Liberty Records. And that came out February 7th with Buy From Me the Rain on it, our first hit.
I want to go back to some of the early music from Nitty Gritty Dirt Band before Will the Circle Be Unbroken.
Yeah.
Let's play Michael Nesmith's tune. Set this up for us.
This is off the fifth album we made. The first four albums were kind of eclectic. They put the tick in eclectic. But they were just very... a learning process. I loved the music. We were playing good time music, ragtime, jug band stuff. But we had done Paint Your Wagon after Buy From Me the Rain, and that took us up to the set in Oregon for 4 months.
You were in the film Paint Your Wagon.
Yes, we were. We're on the credits, and when you see a poster, Nitty Gritty Dirt Band is number five. We did Hand Me Down That Can of Beans, which took 4 months to shoot. It didn't take 4 months of shooting that. It took 4 months to get to it. And we were in the film as extras and stuff, walking around town. And then we were the miners that played on the wagon doing this song that Lee Marvin was dancing in the mud to at 10 o'clock at night. And after the Paint Your Wagon, it was shot in Baker, Oregon, we went back to L.A. and Jeff kind of broke the group up. He said, I don't want to do this anymore, and I don't like a couple of the guys, and let's just quit. It's been a good run. We made four albums. Well, then 6 months later, we were in a club, and Jeff and I looked at each other and said, let's get the group back together, because we were watching Poco. You know the group Poco?
Yeah, yeah.
And they were called Pogo then, P-O-G-O. I don't know if you knew that.
I did not know that.
Well, Walter Kelly hadn't sued them yet. And
was Richie Fury in the band?
Yeah, the original Poco, yeah. Pogo. And, you know, Randy Meisner, Jimmy Messina. But when Walter Kelly sued them because of the comic strip Pogo, they changed the name to Poco. That was a pretty good way to get out of that. And they put out their album, but they had a singing drummer, George Grantham. And Jeff and I said, we need to get a singing drummer and start playing again. We can do this. And we found Jimmy Ibbotson. Now, Jimmy Ibbotson led to the new energy and songwriting and voice. And along came Some of Shelley's Blues. Some of Shelley's Blues was from Mike Nesmith, who was running the Hootenannies at the Troubadour for $15 on a Monday night.
This is before he joins the Monkees.
Yeah, that was way before that. We got to know Michael a little bit, although he was always a little reclusive because his mother invented whiteout and he got all the money. But that's why he could work for $15 a night. But he said, come up to the house, I'll give you a demo of that song. He did. Jeff and I went up and got it and took the demo home and put it on the Uncle Charlie and His Dog Teddy album. This is Some of Shelley's Blues. And my big accomplishment here was putting the five-string banjo on the radio.
Here's Some of Shelley's Blues from John McEwen and the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band right here on 88.5 FM.
Just one more time, the reason why you must leave. Tell me once more why you're sure you don't need me. Tell me again, but don't think you'll convince me.
Yeah, what really made this different was having those halftime drums. Boom. I'll play a little bit of that. That's Jimmy's wonderful harp. Yeah, that was the start of our version of country rock to me.
Well, this was, we're talking about the late 60s now, right?
Yeah, well, when we were recording, yeah. 69, album is said to come out in 70.
So many great stars, eventual stars, were in this milieu. We talked about like Mike Nesmith writing this song.
Well, there was this kid hanging around the Troubadour that said, "Hey, well, you guys want to do some of my songs? Would you do some of my songs? I got some songs. I got a lot of good songs." And he was so adamant about it. I said, "Well, come up to my house." I lived in Laurel Canyon. And he came up to the house, which was a one-bedroom apartment. And nobody had any money then. You didn't even know if you're going to get money. What is money? You know. But he came up and I recorded 7 songs. And 5 of them were his, and it was Kenny Loggins. And the first recording of House at Pooh Corner was, we put 4 of his songs on the Uncle Charlie album. And House at Pooh Corner came out really good. And Jimmy Fadden played guitar on this, and I am mad at him because he never played guitar again after that. And it was a genius part. And just wonderful.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of House at Pooh Corner. This is written by Kenny Loggins.
And Jimmy Ibbotson sings this one again. And anyway, it was just a wonderful time back then. Oh, well, the thing about this is we're going to put it out as a single. Oh, go ahead. Let it go.
Christopher Robin and I walk along under branches lit up by the moon, posing our questions to owl and the oar as our days disappear all too soon. But I wandered much further today than I should, and I can't find my way to the 3-acre wood. So help me if you can, I've got to give back to the house at Pooh Corner by one. You'd be surprised, there's so much to be done. Count all the bees in the hive, chase all the clouds from the sky.
Well, Jimmy was really hot on that guitar. That's about one of the 5 songs he could play.
Well, you were a Nitty Gritty Dirt Band at this point. It's kind of a rock and roll band.
We had aspirations to be, but country is where the heart was. And Jimmy Ibbotson loved singing anything. And he did quite well. That's him on this one. And he became the voice of the band along with Jeff. But Jimmy was more predominant, I think, more energy. And the story about this song is I told Kenny, we're going to put that out as a single. He was so excited about that. In his first recording, his first single of one of his songs. And we got a call from the record company that said, Disney called and said, you can't put that out. I had to call Kenny back, and he was so bummed out.
Because they own the name Pooh?
Yeah, because they own the rights to everything Pooh Corner. And he's on the phone. Oh, man, I hate to hear that. And his girlfriend was saying, what's wrong? Well, Disney won't let the Dirt Band put out Pooh Corner. Well, let me call my dad. Her dad was the CEO of Disney. We didn't know it. He didn't know
it. Nice to have friends in high places.
Yeah, he didn't know. And so the record company got a call the next day. You can put it out.
Well, John McEwen is our guest. He's the co-founder of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. He has quite an extensive history in country music, and we're going to talk a lot about that. This is 88.5 FM. John, back in the day, and we're going back to the mid to the late 60s, Linda Ronstadt's hanging out
being
with you guys. You guys play with the Doors a couple of times. Talk about the Doors and Linda Ronstadt.
Well, everybody played high schools in those days. You could play at 1 in the afternoon high school, the Doors, Association, the Birds. All these people would go out and make $800 or $1,000 playing a high school. Back then it was a lot of money. And there were no expenses. You were in town. We did a college show in L.A. with them, and it was at a college, that was the first one. But then we ended up on a 2-week tour with the Doors on the East Coast, and that was like, oh.
What was that like?
I wasn't a fan. I wasn't a fan of the mood or the attitude. The musicians were great, but Morrison thought more of himself than anyone. You know, he thought everybody had a right to his opinion kind of guy.
I've heard you play Love Me Two Times on your guitar.
Oh, that's a joke.
You nail it, though.
Well, yeah, but that's just a takeoff to put us back in that time. That shows the power of their music. Now, for me, when Morrison sang, "Well, I will always love you," for you know that song?
Yep.
Yeah, it goes into that. That shows what he really was. He was a lounge singer. A lounge singer with a rock band. Now, the band was incredible. They came up with licks. They had a sound. They put the music out there.
Well, but the keyboard player, Ray Manzarek, was a big fan of John Coltrane's.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. But was there a lot of drugs when you did the tour?
Excuse me? What? I'm sorry, man. What was that you saying? You have some drugs? No. I was never a drug guy, and so it was really easy to spot those who were. Yeah, there was drugs and alcohol. It was basically what ruined everything at some point in time, somewhere. It'll ruin it for somebody.
Look what happened to Jim Morrison.
Yeah, and even I was watching a David Crosby interview, and he said, you know, it was a recent interview. He was saying, "Those drugs? No good. Nothing good ever came out of them. Nothing. Nothing. I've been clean for 18 years, and I've got a lot to do." And, you know, it was like, I'm glad you woke up, because you're still here. But what about grace and one pill makes you smaller? I never got along with that. I didn't like the selling of something that you don't know what it's going to do to somebody.
You met a young Linda Ronstadt.
Yes. We were all young. Don't say that way. When you were young, that'd be better, you know? I was 22 years old, 20 years old. Linda was at the Troubadour with the Stone Ponies trying to make it as a singer. And different drum had come out, but nobody knew it was Linda Ronstadt unless the station guy identified her, but he most likely wouldn't know. It was a group time. That was the Stone Ponies, you know? But she was hanging out at the Troubadour too, whenever she wasn't on the road working. And keep in mind that after Different Drum, the Stone Ponies were getting work, but she was still sharing an apartment with somebody.
She hadn't made it big.
No. And they'd go out and make $5,000, $8,000, and it would cost $4,000, $7,000 to do the show. Airfares, rental cars, hotels, commissions. And she'd come home with $100, you know, so she had to share an apartment. That was late 60s, early 70s. But Linda was always a special singer. I remember one time when people would get a job doing an album, it was a wonderful thing. We all celebrated. Hey, so-and-so's got a record deal. Let's go to, they're going to be recording. And you'd end up sometimes going to the studio to watch them record because there's going to be a lot of free food there. And if you were home, able to go to the studio, that meant you weren't working and you needed that free food. you know, so you go nibble at the session. And I was in the vocal booth of of the Linda Ronstadt sessions on Ventura Boulevard in the Valley around 10:30 at night, and I'm listening through the headphones, and she came out and said, "Oh, I have to do a vocal on this." "Oh, okay, here's the headphones, I'll leave." "No, you stay here, I'll sing to you." And so without hearing any of the track, because she had headphones on with the track, she sings, "Well, I will always love you. Will you still love me tomorrow?" Sorry.
To you.
Yeah, it was like, to me, it was to me, okay? But yeah, it was to me. And I'm going, yes, tomorrow. But Linda was an intriguing artist person to me because she was very sensual. But you didn't want to, at least for me, I didn't want to touch her. I wanted to admire that voice in that body with those movements and everything. It's like, oh my God, you know? And then after the song's over, let's go have lunch, you know? She was just, she was like a kid.
Mm-hmm. You write about a rumor that was going on about Linda in your autobiography, The Life I've Picked, A Banjo Player's Nitty Gritty Journey. You want to tell that rumor?
Well, I had heard, and everybody had heard, that when Linda played the troubadour, because it was one of the places to play, that she didn't wear panties. So guys would sit in the front row and see what they could, you know, figure out. And I asked her while I was writing my book, because before I published this book, I was sending her stories, and she was, "Send me more, send me more." And I avoided sending her the Linda Ronstadt story. But then I had to ask her that question. "Of course I did. I wore panties every show. My mother made my panties." You know, it's like, it was so much fun to find out that her mother made her panties and that she wore them with pride. And, but...
She was a nice girl.
She was a nice girl.
Yeah. John McEwen is our guest, and he'll be playing at the Hideaway Cafe.
Yeah, I'm looking
next
forward
week
to that.
In St. Petersburg on the 17th, and also at the Music Compound in Sarasota on the 18th. By the way, next week on the 19th is your birthday, so happy birthday.
Aw, thank you.
And John is also going to be playing at the Capitol Theater along with Hot Tuna on the 28th of this month.
Yeah.
And then Derry Down before that in
Derry Downs in Winter Haven is Graham Parsons' Derry Down.
Did you know Graham Parsons?
No, I didn't.
Yeah.
I wasn't a fan, but I didn't know him.
Yeah.
By choice.
So where did the idea for the album Will the Circle Be Unbroken come from?
Girl Scruggs came to see us in 1970 at the Vanderbilt University. Now, what happened there is Gary tells me he was driving, I was driving Dad to the Opry, and I knew you guys were in town, and I said, "Hey, Dad, you want to go see that Nitty Gritty Dirt Band?"
This is his son, Gary.
Yeah, his son, his oldest son, Gary, who's the last Scruggs alive. And so he brought the whole family to Vanderbilt University that night. And I asked Earl why he came to see us. He goes, "I wanted to meet the boy that played Randy Lynn Rag the way I intended to." And that was, what a compliment that's never left my head.
I want to play something from the Ken Burns documentary, and this is you speaking about Earl Scruggs.
Sure.
Let's just listen to a short bit from Ken Burns' great documentary about country music, and this is our guest, John McEwen.
Earl Scruggs took a form of music that doesn't play scales, a form that he created, Scruggs style. He's not playing a lot of scales. He's playing around the chord changes in a way that puts exciting notes in that people have been looking for years. Earl Scruggs, banjo playing, it's a lot like Elvis Presley impersonators. All the Elvis impersonators sound like each other, but they don't sound like Elvis. All those who try to play like Earl sound like each other, but guess what? There may be two that sound like Earl.
Well, so would you be one of those two that sounds like Earl?
No.
But you can play banjo.
Well, yeah, but there's a certain, there's a couple other people. J.D. Crowe was really good at sounding like Earl. Also, oh, come on, what's his name? He makes instruments in Nashville. Oh, it'll come to me. Never mind.
We'll think of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he's in the Earls of Leicester, though, that bluegrass group. But to sound like him in the simplicity and the complexity at the same time, it was a magic thing. And it had to do with the right hand more than anything.
What was the relationship between country musicians and rock and roll musicians in 1969, 70, 71, before Circle came out?
Well, it was a little contentious for some, but some of the country people were wanting to know more about rock and roll or the people or the playing. And the people that played rock and roll, take Duane Allman, for instance. I heard Duane Allman's daughter called me. Oh, I was doing an interview or so. I'm talking to Duane Allman's daughter, and she said, "My daddy told me that he taught my mom how to play Wildwood Flower on the guitar." Now, I thought, that is incredible. I can just hear him going, dan, 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 dan. No, it's not like that. You do that, dan, 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 you know. So Duane Allman knew country music. He happened to play rock and roll, considered one of the top guitarists ever. And so you had that going. And you had people like Bill Monroe who didn't want to hear any of it. Music to Bill Monroe is Bill Monroe music, you know, and it just because you were on the charts didn't mean anything.
You got, was it you or was it somebody else that got Merle Travis, Doc Watson, Maybelle Carter, all to record this album?
The way that came about was when Earl came to see the Dirt Band, I got to know him. 6 months later, he's in Colorado playing a club called Tulagi's for 5 days. I'm taking him back to the hotel every night. I lived in Colorado. And I finally got up my nerve to say, Earl, Mr. Scruggs, Earl, I was wondering, yes, John, what is it? I was wondering, would you maybe play on an album with the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band? And he said, I'd be proud to. And that was the beginning. That point was the beginning. And a week later, Doc Watson was at the same club, Tulagi's. And I didn't know Doc. I knew Merle, his son, because I'd met him a couple months earlier in Pasadena, California. They were doing a concert. And I told him, you know, I just want to record with you people, some of you people, like Earl. And I'm going to ask Earl when he's in Colorado and if he'd maybe record with us. Well, you make sure you let me know what happens there. We're going to be there a week later. And I went up to him and says, Merle. Earl said, yes. Oh, let me introduce you to Daddy. And he did, and it was different. Hi, Doc. I'm John McEwen. We're making an album with Earl Scruggs. I want you to be part of it. Well, if Earl's going to be there, I want to pick. And I talked to my brother that night, who was a manager and record producer and album designer, William E. McEwen. He designed the album Circle, which got a Grammy nomination. And I talked to him that night. I'm going to get Merle Travis. Yeah, maybe Earl could get us Jimmy Martin. Well, Louise got us Jimmy Martin. One of the guys in the band said, who's Jimmy Martin? And I'm like, you'll find out. He is the best bluegrass singer.
How did you get Maybelle Carter?
Earl Scruggs and Louise together called Maybelle up and asked her if she would do it. And since Earl was there, our doorway to some of those people, verification that we were okay and that we would honor the music. Maybelle always called us the Dirty Boys.
All recorded in Nashville?
Yeah, we were set to record in Nashville. And 8 weeks after I asked Earl that question, we started recording, which was in between. We did 21 dates on the road, working our way towards Nashville. And my good banjo had gotten stolen in Miami, and I had to pick one up in Gainesville on the way to Nashville and play it, try and get used to it. But that's the one that ended up on the Circle album, and it's in the Cleveland Rock and Roll Hall of Fame now. I didn't like it. Yeah, here, how about the banjo that was used on the Circle album?
So I don't
have to store it anymore.
Let's listen to a track from the Will the Circle Be Unbroken album, which was a breakthrough album in 1972. Lots of critical acclaim.
Oh, can you play Lonesome Fiddle Blues?
I was going to play Roy Acuff.
Well, if Lonesome Fiddle Blues
okay,
has Vassar Clements on it.
Okay.
And Vassar is a Florida boy.
Well, that would be appropriate.
Yeah, and so I thought that would be cool.
I'll tell you what, let's listen to a little bit of Roy Acuff right now, because this is one of the songs that caught the public attention back in 1972.
filled with sin. I wouldn't let my dear Savior in. Then Jesus came like an angel in the night. Praise the Lord, I saw the light. I saw the light, I saw the light. No more darkness, no more night. Now I'm so happy, no sorrow inside. Praise the Lord, I saw the light. Just like the blind man, I wandered alone. Wearies and fears I claimed for my own. Then like the blind man, that God gave back his sight. Praise the Lord, I saw the light.
Well, I was saying that people, that Roy Acuff was on that, but yeah. Who was that singing right there?
Well, Jimmy Martin told me before we started this song, is when my verse comes up, I'm going to sound so much like Acuff, you won't be able to tell us apart. And it's really hard. He sang that second verse there. That was the first hit Roy Acuff had in years. It went to number 17.
Well, we're listening to John McEwen here on WMNF in Tampa. John is one of the co-founders of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, and this is 88.5 FM. Let's listen to Vassar Clements and set this up for us, John. Vassar was on this album, too.
Yeah, this is in the key of D minor. It's Lonesome Fiddle Blues. It's a song that Charlie Daniels used to rip off so he could do Devil Went Down to Georgia. And that's another story. But when we recorded this, I asked Bill, how long do I have to learn this? He goes, oh, you got an hour or two. I said, okay, that's enough. But I was out in the hallway learning the song of Vassar. Okay, what's next? And Bill opens the door and says, we got to do Lonesome Fiddle right now. And, oh, no! Because I'm playing in G-tuning in the key of D minor. And it was something that hadn't been done before. But it was possible. I thought, this will be fun to try. But no! So what happened is you hear, now, that sounds musically better than what I intended. I meant to go, but I got stuck, and I had to learn this off the record. Lonesome Fiddle Blues. Randy Scruggs playing right there. And Randy Scruggs has left the building, as they say. And he was 17 years old.
Incredible. Yeah. I would imagine there's never been a gathering of musicians of this caliber in one place that ever.
Oh, this happened, and we were just lucky we captured the moment at the time. And but Vassar was just incredible, and that's Les. Les goes out on the road with me now. I called him a couple years ago and said, Les, do you want to go out and play? He goes, yeah. And so when I usually go on the road, I take John Cable, who's playing with me at the Hideaway Cafe on the 17th, and Les Thompson, who's an original. John Cable was in the Dirt Band. He went to Russia with us. And things like that.
I want to talk about that in a moment.
Okay. Les Thompson was in the original Dirt Band, played mandolin and bass. And Matt Cartsonis goes out with that troupe that I call John McKeown and the String Wizards. And here, this let this song end. Yeah.
So what was it like behind the scenes as you're recording Will the Circle Be Unbroken? What was the relationship between all these great musicians?
We were worried at first day, maybe the middle of the second day, but... Because we're so much younger than they are, and you know, Maybelle was the angel that bothered to be with us. But we found out she called us the Dirty Boys, and we found out that they wanted to be close to our audience, and we found out that they... Well, Roy Acuff talking to Maybelle, for instance, was, Maybelle, it's really good to be here in the studio with you finally after all these years. Oh, Roy, I've always wanted to make a record with you. And they were just all nice people. And they wanted to meet each other away from the Opry. You know, you go do the Opry and you're getting ready for your spot and you go do it and the next guy is getting ready for his spot. And you don't really mingle musically. And what this was a mingling musically. Vassar, who we wanted to make a point of putting on the left side of the album with everybody else's name, was a star. Only he had been an album player. He didn't get credit. I had heard Vassar on a dozen albums before I met him. Earl Scruggs said, well, I found a fiddle player that can handle all the styles. His name's Vassar Clemons. I said, Vassar Clemons, well, can he do it all? And Earl just said, he'll do. That Vassar from Kissimmee, Florida.
The Kissimmee Kid, right?
Yeah.
Did they call him? Yeah.
He had a song called Kissimmee Kid, too. And but he was out there in front, and that was so much fun.
What did the album do to the career of your band, Nitty Gritty Dirt Band?
Well, it gave us a boost that was... It is still there today. Only one of the reasons I left Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, which I did 2 years ago, we were only doing one song from this incredible album. I like to do more like six or seven, or I like to work from a list of 10 or 15. Those six or seven will change every now and then. And look, the album's in the Grammy Hall of Fame and the Library of Congress. It's one of the biggest selling records we've ever had. Right now, it's thanks to the Ken Burns documentary, it's number one on three different Amazon charts. And last night I checked before I came in, it was number 32 on the pop chart of country music. Now, I wanted to go out and do more of that music. Because I love that music, and that's what I play mandolin, guitar, fiddle, and, you know, it's that's where my music's from, for me. It's did a lot for the band, yes.
John McCutcheon is our guest, and you're listening to WMNF, and Tampa's one of the co-founders of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. Eventually, just a few years after this comes out, you go to the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
Were you the first band to go to the Soviet first American band?
First American band. They were committed to bringing over an American group, a group, too, not just a solo guy with a group of guys behind him. And thanks to David Hess, who is now a Florida resident, they ended up picking us. They looked at a bunch of other groups. Chicago was a little boring, we heard. You know, the Dead, Grateful Dead were a little risky, you know, and some other groups, but they came to, the Soviet representatives came to see us four times. No collusion. and they finally...
They were checking you out?
We will take Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. And I think they took us because we were safe. We weren't politically aligned, necessarily. We weren't doing everybody get up and tear this place apart kind of music, you know?
The Rolling Stones street fighting man.
Yeah. And we went over and did 28 shows, and it was an incredible time.
So did the Russians know much about bluegrass or authentic country?
No.
Or country rock?
Not at all, really. No, they didn't know much about anything because the records over there were rare. You had to smuggle them in. They were black market. I signed a Temptations album, a Marvin Gaye album, and something else. There were no Dirt Band song albums. There was a place, this will tell you how hard it was because they have Bones records. You don't know what a Bones record
is. I don't.
Now, all these stories are in my book, The Life I've Picked, which, by the way, makes a perfect Christmas present. And you can get it overnight on Amazon. The Life I've Picked, I covered the Circle album with a chapter called The Circle Album. And in the yellow brick, in the red brick road, I cover the Soviet Union, and I talk about Bones records. A Bones record is somebody, I get trip to Paris, I go make Bones record. Okay, good. Telling your friends, not telling the KGB. KGB lets you go. You have to go get an X-ray. We don't have that X-ray machine here. You go get your X-ray, and you take that film, and you take it to a guy's house, and he cuts into the disc, into that rectangular film, he cuts an album. It might be a Stones album, a Beatles, or whatever. And he records an album onto that disc.
This is like the old acetate.
Onto that X-ray.
It's an X-ray.
Yeah, onto the X-ray film that you have now of your chest. You know what I mean?
Now I got it.
And then you take that back to Russia. And, of course, the security guys then, this is like 30 years ago, but the security guys then would, oh, look at this, oh, it's just an X-ray. We let that go. They wouldn't see the album. And then you'd rush to your friend's house, and they'd have two or three recorders set up to record off of that. And it got some of the music out there.
They didn't want the Western influence infecting what was going on in the Soviet Union.
I heard when I was growing up musically that rock and roll was a communist plot to overthrow America. The snare drum, that beat. Well, I think the snare drum was an American plot to overthrow communism, and it worked.
So you were on Soviet television.
Oh, man, that was a trip. We did a show. In the last week, when you go to Moscow, we will do a show that will play to 120, 130 million people. Oh, okay. So Yuri comes to the first or second show in Armenia and takes notes of the whole show. We get to Moscow, and I'm having a pre-production meeting with Yuri, who was an overweight party member that was the director, and he says, well, we get to song number 7, and Jan Garrett will sing Break My Mind. We took a female singer with us because we were representing American music, and we didn't want to just have the male side. So Jan from Aspen, yeah, she went along. It was... But Yuri, we only did Break My Mind on the first couple of shows. We're doing a different song now. We're doing Georgia. No, song number 7, we get to it, you will do Jan Garrett, Break My Mind. Yuri, we have a problem with that. Jan hasn't sung that. We don't do that. This other song is better. You must do Break My Mind. And it's like, oh, Jan. Jan pops in to say something to me and says, Yuri here wants you to do Break My Mind instead of Georgia. And she goes, tell him he can sing it. I'm going to go to the hotel. And I said, Yuri, she's not going to do it, see? And he's getting all hot. I said, Yuri, there's a difference between you and me. You're a communist. You have to do what? I'm sorry. You have to bleep that.
We had to bleep that.
Okay. I do whatever I want. And he's getting all red. The blood vessels are swelling up. But I know you have to let people save face. And so I said, Yuri, here's what we do. Jan will sing Georgia, but you call it Break My Mind. We do that.
John McEwen is our guest, and this is WMNF in Tampa. So you taught comedian and banjo player Steve Martin how to play the banjo. Did I get that story right?
Well, we were both learning at this. I've never been muted before, but I've never said that before. Sorry.
So far, the FCC hasn't closed this down. They could be here any minute.
Sorry, Mom. Steve and I started playing at the same time in Garden Grove. We got our dream job at 16 years old, working in the magic shop in Disneyland, which is what we wanted to do. And we weren't playing music yet, but a couple years later, we started. And I was learning things faster than him. He's kind enough to say that I taught him, but I kind of did.
So were you on the King Tut song?
Yeah, the Dirt Band was the group on King Tut, and that was just because he came to Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. We were playing in the 77. Came into the dressing room and said, "Hey, guys, I got this idea for a song. Every time I say this, you go, King Tut. And bass player, you go, doom, 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 doom. And then King Tut. And then I'll sing." And then we worked it up in the dressing room. We went out on stage that night. And it, you know that Paul Simon song? "He blew the room away." Well, he blew the room away. It was really fun. And a week later, we were in Aspen, where my brother had a studio. My brother was managing Steve by this time. We had gone through high school, 3 years at the magic shop. He tried to start his career. He got going. And then by the mid-70s, it was going along. And fine, just fine. And living the dream, basically. And we got to Aspen, and we recorded it in 7 hours, and Bill mixed it, and the record company wouldn't put it out.
Why not?
They don't want, well, it's not, the comedy record isn't going to work. So Bill made up 25 acetates, our version of a Bones record.
That's right.
Acetates were the demo version. And sent them to 25 stations like BCN in Boston and ABC in New York, LS Chicago.
The big rockers.
Yeah. And within 3 weeks, it was getting to the top 20. And they were calling the record company, calling the record company saying, "How many King Tuts have you sold?" And they said, "None. We don't have it out as a single." "What? We're charting it at number 18. You better get a single." They put out a single.
So is that you guys doing backup singing?
Yeah, and Brian Savage plays the sax, and he was in another group that my brother was managing, a group called Starwood. He now plays on his own in Aspen. I think he's still up there.
And you were actually on the SNL show.
Yeah, we did King Tut on Saturday Night Live.
What was that like?
It was unforgettable because of the weather. It was the week that a huge storm had hit New York. The island was closed for 2 days. People were skiing down Broadway for 2 days. Cabs were trying to drive, but they were going sideways, sliding off the road. We had to walk from our hotel to NBC every day for rehearsal. You start rehearsing on Tuesday for that show. You have to be there waiting around to go do your 3 minutes. But when Randy Newman was on, we did Short People with him. We did King Tut. We did one of my songs, Return to Dismal Swamp. It was really fun.
John McEwen is here, and this is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. I want to play a song. This is a Moonlight Dancing, and I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about Moonlight Dancing, your song.
Well, I wanted to find a piece of music that wasn't bluegrass and wasn't whatever, and I played enough banjo already, and so I was just falling in love with my now current wife, who happens to be a Puerto Rican, and I thought I'd write something that might appeal to her side of the fence. Because when I met her in Tampa, by the way, at a golf tournament, and I said, you know, "Hi, nice to meet you. Have you ever heard of a group called Nitty Gritty Dirt Band?" She goes, "No, I don't think so." "Oh, okay. Oh, I've heard that before. Okay. Have you ever heard of Mr. Bojangles?" "No, I don't think so." So I met somebody that was meeting me instead of an album cover. And it was very exciting. as it continues to this day to be so. So she was asleep, and I was writing this with a little multi-track recorder in the room. We were on the road somewhere. Go ahead, play it.
Here's John McEwen, and the song is from the Acoustic Traveler CD. This is Moonlight Dancing.
Are we on?
Yeah, we are.
Okay, that's easy. It's a mistake, folks. He got the wrong song. That's Moonlight Dancing. Which one was it? I haven't played that CD myself. I think it's number 5.
Yeah, that was track 5. Well, I'll tell you what. We were setting that up
so nicely for your wife.
Okay.
Let's see if I can find this. You know, I've got another song cued, and it's from your new vinyl album.
Ah.
And... I see. It's track number 6 on this.
Oh, let's gosh,
get the right,
my bad.
Let's get the right track here. Here's Moonlight Dancing from John McEwen.
Let's dance.
That's
cool. Thank you.
John McEwen here on WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. John is going to be playing at the Hideaway Cafe on Central Avenue on the 17th of this month.
Along with John Cable and whoever else might show up.
And Bart Hanchy, is he going to be there?
Bart Hanchy, a wonderful guitar player from Tampa.
And then the Music Compound, he'll be playing in Sarasota at the Music Compound on December 18th. And then the Capitol Theater on the 28th of this month with Hot Tuna. And at Derry Down in Winter Haven on the 20th of this month. John, let's go out with a song.
Okay. This is a guitar detuning. We'll see what comes out of it today.
John McEwen, thank you so much for coming by WMNF. It's an honor to have you here. Thank you for coming by. I should say that this entire interview is on video. It's on the WMNF News Facebook page, and you can watch it back at WMNF News on Facebook. John, thanks, and come back. Come back and visit us.
All right. Like I said to my mom, thanks for having me.
You're listening to 88.5 FM. This is WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg. Nola's coming up with the Midpoint program, but first we're going to go up to Washington, D.C. and hear the latest news from NPR.